Welcome to the KRS Molecular Minute Podcast. I am your host, Shadi Nabhan. I'm the chairman of the Precision Oncology Alliance, our growing network of academic institutions, healthcare systems, international sites. All of these sites are collaborating with the KRS scientific team and platform to advance research with the hope that this will improve the outcomes of all patients diagnosed and affected with cancer. I appreciate you tuning in to the KRS Molecular Minute podcast and supporting this podcast, which you can find on all podcast outlets. I would urge you to subscribe to it, rate it, and write a brief review. Let your friends and colleagues know about this podcast. I am sure they will find an episode that matches their clinical pathologic research interest. Today's podcast is with Dr. David Braxton. Dr. Braxton is a pathologist, and he will introduce himself in a little bit, at the Hoge Cancer Institute in Southern California. You know, that place of the country, which is always nice and the weather is beautiful. You could probably tell that I live in Chicago, where the weather is not always great. But Dr. Braxton is joining me today to talk a little bit about his career path and about who is a molecular pathologist. What is molecular pathology? We're going to talk a little bit about that role in the pathology subspecialty, and I will challenge Dr. Braxton by discussing artificial intelligence in pathology, AI in pathology. So there are a few people who may be listening who don't know you are, who you are. We will penalize them later because they have to know who you are. But tell us a little bit about you and how did you, A, end up in pathology and B, end up in Hoge?
Yeah, so right now I'm David Braxton. I'm a practicing pathologist here at Hoge Hospital, Newport Beach. I currently serve as chief of service for molecular pathology. I've been here for about 7 years, highly engaged with our Hoge Family Cancer Institute's Precision Medicine Program. And we've been building a program here for the past 7 years. So yeah, it's an odd story about how I got involved in pathology. Not so odd, but like many of the people who focus on cancer, most of our interests are in, science and nature. And, that was definitely where I started out being interested, growing up in Florida, having a lot of nature around me. I went off to school and majored in biochemistry and got involved in molecular biology at that time. Around that same time, a good friend of mine actually got diagnosed with cancer. He ended up passing away of synovial sarcoma. And so that had a big impact on my interest to pursue cancer and practice in a field related to cancer and do research. And so as I was studying, cell cycle biology back in undergrad, and my friend was diagnosed with that. And, synovial sarcoma is a disease that's defined by translocation, and it impacts the way cancer cells divide. So, that was really the first insight I had into what molecular pathology is and, how it can impact a patient and people in general. So that was an unfortunate story that, got me started down the road looking at molecular and molecular and cellular biology as a career. I went on to medical school and got involved in similar research, studying the way embryonic stem cells divide and, proliferate and differentiate into certain, tissue types. And we were using all sorts of methods to grow stem cells back then. We were also using small molecule kinase inhibitors to inhibit certain pathways and, drive them into, liver cell fates or pancreatic cell fates. And so that really established my understanding of how cells differentiate and those signaling pathways that control growth and differentiation and, introduced me to the concept of targeted therapies. And so, you know, later some of those drugs went on to be called, you know, targeted therapies. And it was really just a great insight to have leading into, you know, a residency program in pathology. It got me very interested in, you know, the field of precision medicine.
Fascinating. It's an unfortunate, sad stories that you mentioned, but, you know, hopefully you're able to make sure that the legacy of your friend sustains through the research that you're doing and through the advancements that are happening. David, you do this molecular pathology thing. And I think for those who are not familiar with pathology as a specialty, we obviously recognize the role of a pathologist. But are we in an era where we have subspecialized pathology at this point? In other words, is there a GI pathologist, a GU pathologist, a breast pathologist? Is the era of general pathologists gone?
In some respects, yeah, I think so. In general, I still think that there are a lot of, you know, general community practices where you have a pathologist that has to do everything. And so that's just the state of many small practices right now. Not a bad thing in necessarily, but a lot of the larger academic centers are now training pathologists in very subspecialized area. Me, for instance, I'm also practice subspecialized GI liver pathology. So a lot of those kinds of diseases I specialize in, as well as the inflammatory aspects of, you know, hepatology and inflammatory bowel disease diagnosis. Yeah, along those specialty lines, there's a lot of interest and a lot of demand for those kinds of expertise, especially in larger institutions. And it is sort of a hot topic or controversial topic on whether you need to specialize or not coming out of a residency program. I think it's good to have subspecialized expertise. I think even if you end up in a general practice somewhere, that value, you're going to have value for those expertise that you bring. So yeah, I think it's a field in transition right now from a general practice to a more subspecialized practice. And as we see, maybe some consolidation in healthcare and larger institutions forming, there'll be increased demand for more of a subspecialty based practice in pathology.
The residency for pathology, is it 4 years?
Yeah, we got a 4-year. Usually it's anatomic and clinical pathology for 4 years as a combined board certification. And then you can pursue subspecialty based fellowships after that.
Okay, so you do 4 years and then there's 1 to 2 years if you choose to do a subspecialty. In other words, I guess my question is, it's not that you subspecialize during these 4 years. The 4 years are always general pathology. You have to do extra training to subspecialize.
Correct. Yeah. So in some of the areas are board certified, subspecialized, and you have to sit for a subspecialty exam. Molecular genetics is one. Hematopathology has a board certification exam. Cytopathology does. And then you have the anatomic pathology subfields, which typically you don't sit for a board certification exam at the end of your fellowship year. So if you want to do GU pathology, you can subspecialize in that. GI pathology, you can do neuropathology, all sorts of different anatomic areas. Those typically don't have a certification exam at the end of those years, but they are organized fellowships.
But in addition to what you do with liver, inflammatory disease, and GI, you do consider yourself a molecular pathologist.
Correct. Yeah. So I definitely
What is a molecular pathologist?
So a molecular pathologist is you know, someone who specializes in the detection of diseases based on their molecular analytes, right? So usually that's DNA and RNA in practice. And so that field evolved out of, you know, old PCR based technologies, really started I guess with, you know, the Philadelphia chromosome when that was discovered. So that was an old cytogenetic finding, and a lot of the field has evolved out of both infectious diseases, being able to detect viruses and such with PCR based tests, but also really has come along now in cancer, where we can look at the actual disease causing mutations that are occurring in these patients. So a molecular pathologist really could practice in a number of areas. Cancer is one, infectious disease is another. Germline genetics is also a very active field for us. In practice, you usually sort of pick one area or something. So my area would be cancer that I do here at Hoge Hospital.
That's very helpful, but it makes me ask the question, I mean, so as a GU pathologist or as a breast pathologist, you must be familiar with the molecular aspect of breast pathology, right? I mean, or of GU pathology. So do you get a phone call, let's say, from the GU pathologist, like, hey, David, you know, I need your help in this case on the molecular level? I'm trying to understand, because like the intersection between a specialized pathologist and a molecular pathologist, how that interaction happened.
I think there's a lot of synergies that can occur with that when you have a expertise in molecular as well as an anatomic area. So that, you know, it really is a good thing to be able to understand the biomarkers and keep up with them on your own, in your own anatomic area, whether it's GU, breast, brain. Those are rapidly developing fields where new biomarkers are coming on all the time. The diagnostic criteria for things like brain tumors are now heavily reliant on molecular biomarkers. We can't even diagnose, a glioblastoma, a malignant brain tumor now without having molecular techniques integrated into that diagnostic. So it is really a dynamic field that's changing. So if you are practicing pathology right now, you are integrating more and more molecular pathology and biomarkers into your practice, whether you like it or not. And that's just the way it's going to go, I believe. There's such a high demand and high pace of change right now, where we are constantly trying to revise what we're doing, bringing on more of that expertise into the general anatomic areas. So that's just, that's just the way it's going right now. So most of the general pathologists here are having to integrate more and more molecular into their practice on a daily basis now.
So are you involved, for example, whether a clinician, let's say, picks up the phone and calls you, or another pathologist says, I have this case, what test should I do to get a better diagnosis? Do you get to decide, for example, the optimal test for a particular patient? Or because there are so many out there, frankly, and I think the clinicians, I hope the new clinicians are being trained into this, but I can tell you, when I was seeing patients, it wasn't something that we were trained in. Things have changed a lot. So do you get these calls like, hey, what should I do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my day could be comprised of a lot of consultations with peers, oncologists or surgeons or other kinds of doctors regarding, hey, we got an inpatient, we think they have metastatic lung cancer. How do we get this patient tested as soon as possible? What do we need to look for? So those are definitely coming up on an almost daily or weekly basis, those kinds of consultations with peers. With other pathologists, they happen multiple times a day, especially with things like Lynch syndrome screening that we do for colorectal and endometrial cancers. So there's always some molecular issues going on with how to interpret either the mismatch repair or, the situation that the patient finds themselves in with some sort of a nuance with regard to Lynch syndrome screening. So there's all sorts of issues, especially when we integrate in some of these comprehensive NGS reports into a practice where those mutational results may change our diagnosis or refine our diagnosis, especially in the setting of a carcinoma of unknown primary. We can go back and look at where those mutations are occurring, what genes and start to pick out some patterns and maybe make a more refined diagnosis based on integrating that. So those kinds of consultations are happening on a daily basis and much more frequently now.
But hey, listen, once we have artificial intelligence working its way, I don't know what you're going to do with your life. Have you thought where you're going to go fishing?
maybe up the coast in Alaska or something, but
obviously I'm kidding, but so much talk about AI, and a lot of the talk about AI honestly is mainly in two specialties, pathology and radiology. Tell me your thoughts about AI. What have you, you're hearing a lot about. Help us briefly separate, I guess, the signal from noise.
Yeah, I like to say when I see our radiology colleagues go out of business, that's when I'll get I'll get a little nervous. but AI is definitely, we've seen a lot of improvement in the algorithm and the performance of these. We have had some engagements over the past few years utilizing AI, not just for digital pathology, but so other kinds of informatics applications. The natural language processing got very good. It could actually read our pathology reports and be able to tell us if this specimen that we had a report on, if that was a metastatic lung cancer or not. So, I mean, it's getting very good in some applications. And then when you look at what's going on with digital pathology, whole slide imaging, and AI, I think it's going to be a very powerful technology. I liken it to what NGS did. Right. So we were, 10 or 15 years ago, NGS was not quite good enough for clinical applications. Right. It was very controversial whether or not we'd be able to get NGS into the clinic. I think you're seeing the same kind of application arc here with digital pathology, where we're finding out what it's good, what this technology can help us do. We're trying to do some of these early applications and sort of kick the tires on it before it's going to catch fire. And I think it's really going to have vast applications, not just in pathology, but I think it's going to have applications all through healthcare once it matures a little bit more.
But in pathology, is your vision of where AI is going to be, let's just throw an example. Let's say you're looking at a case, maybe slides, whatever it is, and you're not sure. I mean, these things do happen. You're 90% sure, but there's some question. Is the idea that AI is going to help you be more precise in the diagnosis, like mitigate error, like where it's going to
like all of the above? Tell you?
Yeah.
It has a number of different applications that we can really project right now and see those developing. Number one is, yeah, accuracy. Could it detect cancer that we may miss? And I like to point out, the time we spend looking at lymph nodes. If you think of a colon resection, we get 20 lymph nodes or so. That could be 40. Slides to look at just through lymph nodes, looking for little tiny metastasis of these cancer cells. And I think AI is going to be very good at picking up very small, very rare events like that and bringing that to our attention. So that's cancer detection. Could it help us with cancer classification? Almost certainly those applications are coming out. And then when you look at our workflows, the efficiency of a pathologist is, sort of a controversial topic. We like to think we're efficient, but when you actually break down how our slides come out, what we have to do to order a stain and things like that, we could be a lot more efficient. And so when you have a 100% digital workflow, the AI running in the background can start doing things similar to what's going on in radiology. It can triage your cases for you. It can bring up those critical or very acute cases to your work list, to the top of your work list, so you can work on them first. It can pre-order stains for us potentially and really get the workflows much more optimized for rapid patient care and rapid diagnosis. So I think there's a lot of applications really across the board for how AI and digital pathology are going to work together, not only to improve pathologist workflows, but to improve the accuracy of our diagnostics, and then give us some applications beyond what we can see through on an H&E. I think that is where that, you know, patient benefit is really going to come out, is what can we do with AI that we can't do with our own eyes. So that's really coming down the line, I think.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, I'm very interested. So I stay really, I try to watch that field carefully. A lot of the research that happens in pathology, molecular pathology, as well as other elements in precision medicine, depend on the data and big data and the availability of data to help answer questions that you just can't answer with a small set of data. And I appreciate you leading our Precision Oncology Alliance pathology group, but I want to try to highlight maybe one or two things that you have led or worked on, at least for listeners to appreciate the value of data and how you apply that into some of the research projects. And I believe you had several things that you've worked on lately, but I'll let you choose which one or two you'd like to highlight.
Yeah. So in terms of big data, I think, the healthcare organizations that can do big data well are going to have a huge advantage. And some of the applications that I've spearheaded here are basically getting a hold of our data streams and being able to build workflows around those data streams. And for instance, we have an ASCO abstract from last year, and we're heading towards publication, where we were able to capture our results coming through a pipeline. And now, based on those genomic results on our cancer patients, we can pick out patients that should go see a genetic counselor. And so we were streamlining that process and making recommendations for, hey, this tumor has a BRCA mutation in it, and that's not typically the cancer type that we see BRCA mutations in. So that could potentially be a germline mutation. So that study's gone forward, and we were able to have a list of genes where, based on this pipeline we built, if the patient has a mutation in one of those genes, they get a referral over to a genetic counselor. And, we had some accrual problems, because that's, a very underutilized service is genetic counseling and genetic testing. But the patients that we were able to get enrolled in this study, we had about a 40, almost 50% rate of confirmation for their germline mutation. So I think, that is a great example of how we can use sort of these data streams that are coming out and make an impact in patient care, because now those half of those patients have, a hereditary form of cancer that we've diagnosed, and that can extend benefit to that patient, but also their family members that might also carry those mutations. So that's one example of what we've done with data here at Hoag that we're sort of proud of. Yeah.
I mean, there is this school of thought, and I heard it, I hear it from some people, that every cancer patient should undergo germline testing. Like, it doesn't matter. Anybody should undergo germline testing. Now, do you think this is going to be mainstream? Do you think that's an exaggeration? What are your thoughts? I'm sure you heard the same from some people.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that study actually came out of, because we wanted to do universal germline testing on our cancer patients. And, there's a lot of issues with doing that. It's how do you deliver that service to all of these patients? It's very complex, requires, we do believe genetic counseling should happen in that situation. So, and then you have to deal with the payers also. And so the genetic testing guidelines have not caught up to where the field is. And so that's a big problem for, I think, our society, is that we have such an underutilized service here with genetic testing that, we are missing patients with hereditary forms of cancer. So I do agree we should probably be offering universal testing to patients, universal germline testing to patients with cancer. It's just, how do you actually deliver that as a service? Is it cost effective? We don't know yet. It is probably in the best interest of the patients to go get a germline genetic test if you have cancer. We're finding the more you look, the more you find. And that's what is just the bottom line. If you look in brain cancers, you're going to find patients with hereditary forms of cancer with, you know, and they present with a brain tumor and not, you know, a typical tumor type that's associated with the germline condition that's sort of written up in the textbook. So,
look, I mean, I think even when we look at somatic testing, right? I mean, you know, we started, you know, 10 plus years ago, people looking at one gene, two genes, and then, you know, broader panel and all of this. And to your point, the more you do, the more you find. And what's different right now is when you find certain things, you may have treatment for these things that you find, you know?
Absolutely. It can make a big impact in that patient, as well as their family. I mean, there's, you know, the best way to treat a cancer is to prevent it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that's what, at least, you know, from an NGS perspective, here, we're doing the whole exome, whole transcriptome under that umbrella. And it, you know, it made me remember, you recall years back, when we used to do the, you know, when we checked the mismatch repair genes for colorectal cancer only in a specific subset of patients that were, you know, MSI high. And then I recall we had a criteria actually that who you would send for the MSI testing. And then subsequently, eventually, every colorectal cancer patient would undergo MSI testing and you would just check for it. But at some, when we started this, for colorectal cancer, it was not that everybody would not check MSI on everyone, but now you do.
Yep. You're absolutely right. There's been, you know, and I think that's a good thing that those criteria have creeped up. It's definitely catching a lot of benefit for patients.
Anything we should share with the listeners also about, I mean, molecular pathology, the intersection of what you do with the clinical, anatomic, and medical oncology? Anything I forgot to ask you think is important to listeners to understand and know?
Well, I think, you know, the power of the technology that's coming out right now with genomics, genetics, and AI, I think it's going to really open up a lot of new areas for us in medicine. And particularly from my vantage point in pathology, there's a number of topics we're watching very closely that I think the public and the industry should start to take notice of. And one of them is clonal hematopoiesis. I think that's a fascinating area. There's all sorts of you know, disease associations with this, and clonal hematopoiesis, for, you know, your listeners, is mutations that occur in the blood forming bone marrow cells. And then those cells go out to circulate through the blood. Those mutations have been associated not just with the development of leukemias. They've been associated with increased risks of everything from heart attacks, stroke, all-cause mortality. Liver disease has been associated with these mutations in the blood-forming cells. So I think it's of public interest, health interest, to understand clonal hematopoiesis a little bit better.
Yeah, well, our hope is with you know, our liquid biopsy platform coming down the pike very soon, we'll be able to really look at that, hopefully in a more methodical way and a scientific manner. Well, David Braxton, thank you so much for taking time of your busy schedule. I appreciate you joining in and sharing your insights and your view with the listeners of the Caris Molecular Minute podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, folks, thank you so much for listening and supporting the Caris Molecular Minute podcast. I appreciate you tuning in. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, rate it, write a brief review, and let your friends and colleagues know about this podcast. Thank you, Dr. Braxton, for joining me on the Caris Molecular Minute podcast. And until next time, take care.